Apple reveals their new operating system, anybody can steal your Facebook account, and AT&T getting ready for LTE. All that and more on this week's Slongcast. Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 17, for Wednesday, October 27th, 2010. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and as usual, I have with me Mr. Ryan Lancey.
How's it going, Kevin?
Can't complain. Getting over a cold. You can probably tell by my voice it's a little more bassy than usual.
It is.
That, and I've been practicing a bass solo for an upcoming concert, so I sound that way a little more often.
Nice.
But enough about me. What's new with you?
Not a whole lot. Heading on a trip pretty soon to Europe next month.
How long?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Nice. Wish I was going to Europe. I have a passport now. I can do that.
Yeah.
I should definitely go.
You should.
Okay, let's get into some tech. This first story came from the Apple press conference that they had. It was last week or 2 weeks ago. Couple big things came out of this. First one, new version of Mac OS X. You probably don't care at all.
I'm glad to see they're supporting their users.
It's a plus.
But nothing, I wouldn't have too much use for it myself.
Yeah, here's the thing that I actually wanted to talk about with this story. We all know that all the mobile platforms have an app store.
Mm-hmm.
So Apple is now making an app store for their real Macs, for the actual operating system that runs on laptops and desktops. What do you think about this? I mean, it seems like they're going away that any Apple application, not just Apple, any application that will run on a Mac, you can get, one-click install from this app store. How cool would that be?
it's neat. We already have a little bit of this in the gaming world with Steam.
Right. This would essentially be Steam for everything else.
Everything other than gaming including. But it's to me, it's not like a paradigm shift or anything. I think this has all slowly been coming. And there's a lot of vendors that offer their applications, for you can download them right from their websites and install them.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever heard of Microsoft has the one click to deploy.
I have heard of that. I've never used it.
Applications. So they have a technology sort of to allow this more online deployment of applications.
Right.
Now wrapping them up into an app store is pretty cool.
That's what I think is the cool part. You have one place to go and hopefully you can get anything.
But the thing that sort of worries me is they may take a very controlling stance on what they allow into the...
They will. They've released some rules already. Things like if your application gives you a license agreement, it will not be accepted. If it takes a serial number, it will not be accepted. There's a bunch of rules coming out.
Really? No. How do they protect against piracy?
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird.
I think it'll be awesome for this to happen. But one thing that I'm worried about, let me start off by saying, I think this is awesome because this is exactly how Linux works now. No matter what distribution of Linux you use, there is a central repository for everything. You don't have to know anything. You just go get your software. So I think it's really cool that Apple is coming out with something similar to that, because anybody who uses Linux, that's probably the thing that they love the most, is you don't have to care about where software comes from. You just type a single command and bam, you get it. So yeah. I love that about this. What I'm worried about is if applications like Final Cut Pro would be in the App Store, does anybody really have enough bandwidth or patience to download a four gigabyte installer?
Yeah.
Although I guess with Steam, you're downloading entire DVDs of games, so you're going to wait that long.
Yeah. Microsoft's been doing this with their, they sell their OSs online now. You can download them.
I know you can get like ISOs, you mean?
Yeah. They take a while to download, but it's not a big, it's not a huge deal.
Right.
I think what they're trying to do is break down the barriers between consumers and vendors. in terms of like finding what you want. Because one of my biggest complaints with any store is, or brick, like a brick and mortar store, is that a lot of times you go there, they advertise something, and then they don't have it in stock.
I hate that.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, we can order it for you. And it's like, well, anyone can order anything nowadays.
I can order it at my house and not go to a store.
Right. In fact, I can order it at your online store, have it shipped to your store, and not even pay shipping.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I mean, I guess maybe that's what they want you to do. But I think part of the problem, not necessarily with that delivery method, but just in general with buying things in a physical store, is that you don't get that instant gratification where like you do with a music download. And I think that's what's made legal music more popular, is that it's so easy to get at.
I totally agree.
So if this leads, you know, towards better deployment of software, you know, and easier access to software, more for consumers, I think it's a good thing. I mean, there's still people that like won't even pay $1.99 for an app. They're like, oh, I want to just jailbreak my phone and get it for free. And it's like, come on.
Yeah, I do think though that you're right. You know, in the legal sense that you give people the option to get something legally, they're probably going to take that option.
Yeah.
You know, if you make it easy for them, if I have to go
reasonably priced,
right? If I have to go to a store, you know, waste my gas, waste my time, pay a lot of money for a box of software, I'm probably not going to do it. But if I can download it online, get it instantly, pay a little less than I would in the store, maybe because I don't have physical media, that's awesome. I'll do that right now. So here's hoping that this turns out to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Next story also has to do with Apple, I believe, is your story.
Yeah, actually, this is really interesting. Came up in the Mac OS X reference library that I guess they have decided that as of the Mac OS X 10.6 Update 3 release of the Java runtime for Mac OS, they are deprecating Java, which means that they are no longer going to update their Java runtime environment, and it will not be provided in future OSs such as 10.7.
So what you're saying is like the software update that automatically updates, that'll no longer happen anymore because it's not quote unquote part of the OS.
Right. Their management of the Java VM for Mac OS has ceased. Now they're going to continue support with the existing versions throughout their normal life cycle.
But makes sense.
Yeah, but you know, they have to support what they've sold.
Right.
But they will no longer make new versions and or anything like that.
Do you see this as a bad thing? I don't, because Microsoft did this a couple years ago. You know, they always included their own version of a JRE, and then they say, you know what? You want Java? Go get it yourself.
Well, actually, what happened with Microsoft was a little more involved in that. They actually extended the JRE, the Java virtual machine, the Java runtime environment, and added features to it, which were not within the specification of the Java, I guess.
Regular Java from Sun.
Right. And I think additionally, the other thing that they did was there was ways to render the Windows in anti-aliased and aliased modes, and they had some problems with the way things would show up if you had an app that was written for the Microsoft JVM and tried to run it on another JVM. There were problems with it. Most developers just took care of it and wrote it to work in both JVMs. It wasn't a big deal for too many people. But it was kind of like how browsers don't all support HTML correctly.
Yeah.
It was an annoyance.
And it's the same way that you could write an extension that works on Firefox for Windows, but you put it on a Linux machine and it breaks.
Right. If the developer didn't do his homework.
Right.
But so that was the, and then actually Sun sued them over this and said that,
as they should.
Well, they took away, they had a license to use it, and that they, I guess that if they redistributed it, it had to work on all machines or whatever. So,
oh, okay. So they let them update it with their own code, but the way they did it, because it didn't work everywhere, they're like,
Right. Okay. So they said you can't do that. So that's why you don't get a JVM. You get a Microsoft virtual machine, which is now totally different than Java.
Right.
I mean, it probably bears some resemblance, but it's different, and it doesn't run most Java apps, as far as I know. So now you're forced to download Java from Sun, and Sun, now owned by Oracle, maintains that JVM. So now this JVM is going to be maintained by Sun.
And personally, I don't think that's bad.
Well, it's bad for a couple reasons. The reason I think it's bad, number one, is that it's going to take a while to write this JVM. There one doesn't exist now that's going to be maintained. So if Java in 2 months, I don't know what Java's plans are.
So wait, you're saying I can't go to Sun's website and download Java for my Mac?
No.
I've never tried, so I don't know.
I should probably have tried that before I came on the program, but I'm fairly certain you can't.
Well, keep talking and I will figure this out.
And the reason is because, as you know, Apple had been very tightly controlled with it. There was always a lot of talk, from what I've read, and if you want, there's a sort of a supplementary article that goes with this. I actually submitted the wrong link. I meant to submit this one from the Register that goes into more detail. And in that article, they link to James Gosling's response to this, because one of the well-known Java developers, I guess, out there sent an email to Steve Jobs about this. And sometimes, as you know, steve@apple.com or whatever it is, sjobs, I can't remember the
name. Sjobs.
Sjobs. Yeah. Sometimes he replies. And his reply was, Sun, now Oracle, supplies Java for all other platforms, Jobs allegedly wrote. They have their own release schedules, which are almost always different than ours, so the Java we ship is always a version behind. This may not be the best way to do it. That was his response. James Gosling has a blog, and he responded in his blog about this. And he said it's simply not true, because a lot of big manufacturers still maintain their own VMs, IBM, HP, and a few others, notably. And that the reason this is a good thing is that they have insight into the proprietary parts of the OS. So the basic Java runtime, if they get it to work on Apple, or maybe that already does work on Apple, the basic one,
right?
It doesn't support all the cool UI features that Mac OS X has.
That has always been my problem with Java on any system, that Java always looked like crap.
Right, but it's been getting a lot better. And those who use Eclipse know that it's pretty good. Now, there's a lot of people who don't like Eclipse.
I'm one of them.
Right, we'll just agree to disagree there. Like, I'm not saying Eclipse is the best thing in the world, but as far as Java applications goes, I think it's excellent.
It's the most, probably, I don't want to say this for certain, but probably the most used IDE for Java.
Yeah, well, right, but it's also written in Java.
Right, which is kind of ironic.
My point is that it's a very good Java application in and of itself.
Right? Oh, okay. That's
you know, the controls and everything are very, it's very customizable, and it does have a very different look and feel from Windows and Linux apps that you normally have, like with KDE or GNOME or the Microsoft Windows Manager, but it's still very, very good.
I agree that it looks decent
because
I have used it before, but I just don't like that you see a Java app, you know it's a Java app.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. You're right. But the purpose of Java is not to be flashy. The purpose of Java is to be platform independent.
Right. Write once, run everywhere.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, so in James Gosling's article, he points this out. He also points out that Apple is very tight-lipped about a lot of their APIs, and that it's going to take a certain specific technical expertise that may actually be unobtainable outside of Apple to write this Java VM for Apple. So, and there's been, I guess, you know, years and years of, persuading Java developers to switch to the Apple platform by some of the Java community. And they have got a lot of Java developers to switch. And now Apple pulls this shit.
Right.
So,
yeah, to quote their website, I did find it on Sun's. Oh, it's java.com. I guess, right. Oracle owns it now.
Yeah.
So they list out, you know, you can download Java for Windows, for Solaris, for Linux. And then they have a section for Apple. And they say, and I quote, Apple Computer supplies their own version of Java. Use the software update feature available on the Apple menu to check that you have the most up-to-date version of Java for your Mac. So I guess sometime soon we're going to see that change into actual download links.
You hope. This is a significant effort.
I don't... Well, here's what I think. Apple knows that Java is huge. They know that a lot of applications use it, enterprises use it. They realize it's huge. They're not going to let the whole system go without Java for too long without giving in. I don't think they would do that.
I don't know.
I mean, cut and paste on the iPhone. Okay, we don't really need that. But taking out an entire way of running applications that enterprises might be depending on, I don't think they would do that.
They've already done that with the iPhone and the iPad. They don't provide Flash for these devices.
That's not mission critical. That's an iPhone and an iPad. Who cares? It's a phone.
Yeah, but if
we're talking about computers now.
I agree with you, but I think this is a shot across the bow. Actually, I think not including Flash support in the iPhone and the iPad was a shot across the bow. I think this is the way forward for Apple. I do not think that they are interested in any way, shape, or form in supporting outside development platforms.
I agree.
I think they want to even if they could do it further, close down their system to the point where they have complete control on what goes on and off it.
And honestly, I think that's why they're good.
It may be, you know, for some things.
Like my machine never has blue screened or the equivalent of a Mac kernel dump. Never happened.
Right.
You know, my Windows machine, a lot.
Well, I mean, some people have different experiences with Windows.
That's true.
You know, I can't say that I've ever had my Windows 7 PC blue screen, except during like first installation when you're like trying to figure out hard drive mappings and all that stuff.
Right.
And we're talking from a home built system. You know, and I even in the case of XP, I think when XP first came out, it was a solid like 2 years before I had a blue screen with the first version of XP. We're not even talking Service Pack 1. So I think the days of like Microsoft's instability are well behind them, and I don't think it's a much of a valid argument anymore. But that said, I'm not saying that this is like a bad thing for everyone out there, because Apple is, I think, now firmly planted in with the idea, or firmly implanted with the idea, of providing electronic devices. I think that's really what their future is.
You think they're moving away from the PC side and going towards things?
I do. And I even at that, I think their PCs may come down to the point where they're really just internet appliance type things.
So you think MacBooks are going to go toward like netbook style uses?
Well, they kind of, and we'll talk about, I think we talk about that later, right?
The next article, actually.
Oh, okay.
We're talking about the MacBook Air.
Yeah, the MacBook Air. Yeah. So we can get to that in a minute. But yeah, I just think that I think this is like a paradigm shift. And, you know, I could be wrong. Maybe Apple's just like, we don't want to spend the money on this because we think Java is not going to be the platform of the future. And whatever they develop their iPad apps in and iPhone apps.
Yeah, it's an Xcode with Objective-C.
Yeah, and I guess my point is like what all the UI layers are written in. If they're like, is it like CSS and HTML5?
No,
or
that's just for websites. I think it's like some sort of like Mobile Coco or whatever the GUI is on normal Macs.
Okay,
it's a
similar thing. So there's something proprietary then, I guess.
Yeah,
the whole thing. They seem to think that it's the way forward for them. And if you think about it, because they've turned over the development of Java, or, you know, basically said we're not doing it anymore, and now they have this app store, it may get to the point where whoever does write the JVM for Apple, they're going to have to get it approved to get it on the app store. So this is going to have to fit into whatever APIs.
I don't...
What I'm saying is this may be coming. Yeah. It may not happen right now, but I think we're in a transition period for Apple. That's my opinion.
No, I was just going to disagree with you about having to get it in the App Store, because I'm still thinking of the iPhone and iPad App Store, and I'm like, you're never going to have Java for that. But then I just remembered that we talked about the Mac App Store.
Yeah.
And that it'll probably have to get in there, yeah.
Yeah, they could at some point lock the OS down that you can only install applications through there.
That would suck. If they do that, I might be out and just go back to my Linux box.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're going to fragment, you know, maybe they're going to have a professional like line and a consumer line, which they kind of do like notionally now.
I don't think, because they always tout when they talk about their OS, with Microsoft, you have to choose from 6 different versions. With us, everybody gets everything for the same price. Like, that's always been their tagline with their OS.
Yeah.
So Unless they have a major change now, you know, that nobody knows about.
It's really interesting, though, and I suggest everyone read the article on it's nighthacks.com is where, I don't know whose website that is, but that's where James Gosling has this post.
I was going to say Ryan Gosling, but he's the dude from The Notebook.
Yeah, not Ryan Gosling.
But the next article follows up in talking about some more Apple stuff.
So the new MacBook Air is out, and you know, it's just, I think this sort of, like, you know, fits well with the previous topic, in that the new MacBook Air, they have two new versions. There's a 13-inch version, and because previously the MacBook Air was a 17-inch version, right?
Or 15, I believe.
15.
Yeah.
So there's a 13, and there's also an 11-inch, and I think the 11-inch is aimed squarely at this, you know, netbook-esque device.
I totally agree.
Though it's well above the price range for most netbooks.
It's about triple 2.5 times.
Yeah. You can get a decent netbook for $280 nowadays, and I think that thing starts at $999.
Yeah.
So,
here's the thing. Let me just complain real quick about that, because I was looking at it. I was watching a MacBreak Weekly and Twit today, and everybody was talking about it. Some people even had it. They were playing with it. And I'm like, you know what? That looks awesome. I would like to buy one of those. So I went and looked, and even with my education discount or my corporate discount, it only takes $50 off the price.
Yeah.
I'm like, come on. I'm not paying $950 for this thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's really neat because it's so thin and light. You know, it's definitely cool that way. But I don't know. I mean, I think the price is just all wrong for them, or for everyone.
Well,
really.
It caters to a specific group of people, and that is not the people who buy netbooks, you know, unfortunately.
The point that I wanted to make about this new MacBook Air, though, is that it's not going to have Flash preloaded. Up until this date, Macs have come preloaded with Flash in the web browser. So when you go to, like, basically any web page on the internet, you don't get a broken link looking thing or a blank.
Please download this plugin.
Right. And they're not doing that with MacBook Air.
Yeah.
And I think this is another sort of, like, you know, knife in the eye or something, or in the back, or
in the heart.
Or something. Poking. I meant to say poking somebody in the eye. Like, you know, when you poke them in the eye.
I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you.
You're tormenting the person. But anyway. I think it's, you know, they're just sticking another one in their side for Adobe.
Yeah, I'm going to have to, well, yes, for Adobe.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to disagree with the whole this is a problem thing, just like I did with the JVM, because nobody else does this. Microsoft doesn't bundle it with IE or Firefox or anything else. Linux doesn't bundle it with anything. If you want, unlike Java, which some things do bundle it with Flash, if you want it, you have to go get it.
Well,
yes, it was a nice thing, but now we're just all on a level playing field.
I agree, but I think this is just Apple's way of saying, you know what, we're done. Like,
I hope they're saying we're done with Adobe. That's what I hope they're saying.
I think they're trying to be like this, like, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example.
They're trying to be a monopoly?
No, they're not trying to be a monopoly. I think what they're trying to do is, like, be like the leader. Like, we think HTML5 is awesome, and we think that's the way forward. So if you want to develop, like he said, there's two ways into our environment, on our platform or through the web. And if you're going through the web, we support HTML5.
They're kind of like Facebook in the aspect that when they think that something is what they want to do, they just do it. They don't care who gets mad. And eventually, if 90% of the people get mad, maybe then they're going to take a step back. But, you know, they do the same thing Facebook does. They just make everybody mad first. Eventually, you'll learn to love it. But, you know, if everybody hates it, then they might step back.
Well, I mean, they still have to face the fact that while there's a lot of iPhones out there on the desktop, the PC is still king.
Oh, definitely.
And not only that, there's still all these, you know, Linux and Unix machines out there, too. I don't see this working for them. I really don't. Like, I think that they have to embrace these technologies if they want to have a wider user base than they already do.
See, that's the thing. I don't think they do.
Well, maybe they don't.
I don't think they care.
But they're going to piss their users off. Like, what happens if, like, eventually, you know, I don't know. What if Adobe just gets pissed and says, fine, we're not making anything for your platform at all anymore. You know, I really think this.
Then all the designers go away.
Yeah. Because, you know, people, no Photoshop. They still love Adobe. People still love it. And there's nothing out there. Like, I was reading an article about iWork 11, I think it is, that comes with iPhoto.
No,
iLife 11.
There's iLife, and then there's like iWork. Well, one of them comes with the office suite and everything, and iLife comes with more of the movie editing. And
right.
The,
well, whichever one comes with iPhoto 11, then or their photo editing software.
Yeah, that's iLife.
There's a scathing article out there about how much it's like. Just I think it was on Reddit, but it was just like all the things they changed that just drove him up a wall and said he's done with Apple like media products. Like he's gonna find alternatives. And
yeah, I've never, even though I have them, I've never really used them. Yeah. You know, the only reason I open up iPhoto is because that's the only way I can get pictures onto my iPhone.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't use it for anything.
Right. So I don't know. I just think they better be careful.
No, I agree. If they're changing all of this stuff, you know, like you say they are, you know, I didn't realize there was such a big change in the new versions of iPhoto and iMovie and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're getting rid of Java, Flash, and now radically changing everything else, that's going to make some people mad.
Well, I don't even know if it's the radically changing thing. I just think it's like that they don't have tools that are as good as this other software. They have nothing that even comes close to like Lightroom or Photoshop or any of the Adobe products. And to be honest, there's probably a handful of other, you know, like GarageBand. Compared to some of the other audio editors out there, it's terrible.
I agree. I don't think it was ever meant to be an audio editor. It was meant for idiots to put together cool sounds.
Right.
But yeah, I agree. Because that is really all you get with an audio editor on your machine.
Yeah. So like, what are you going to get? You're going to get Audacity.
That's what I use.
Which is pretty buggy sometimes. And then, you know, and then otherwise you got to go to some other third party. So unless they're going to start writing all the software, I think they're in trouble.
Yeah, because they could just make everybody mad enough that there is no third-party software in the future, you know?
Yeah.
And then they don't have their own, there's no third-party, they're screwed.
Yep.
Oh, we have yet to see. So a cool thing that was maybe or maybe not leaked from Microsoft in Germany is the Windows 8 release date. So from the German Windows, or where was it? Microsoft Netherlands, sorry. From Microsoft Netherlands, they published an article that marked the one-year anniversary of Windows 7, but in that article, they mentioned Werder worked Microsoft... No, sorry, that's the German. I can't actually do a German voice. But roughly translated into English, they're saying...
I think it's actually Dutch.
Whatever. I don't know what it is, but I can't say it. But whatever it says is that Microsoft, they're on course for the next version of Windows... but it'll take about 2 years before Windows 8 hits the market. So a lot of people were thinking that that was a little slip-up, that it's now October 2010. We should expect Windows 8 around October 2012. So have you heard anything about Windows 8 that would make you excited yet? I haven't.
Not excited. I have read a few things that they're speculating that Microsoft's really going to be throwing the, you know... caution to the wind and embracing the cloud a lot in Windows 8.
I have heard that, but I don't know what that means.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I still don't know how you get around, you know, I mean, unless bandwidth just like goes up tenfold in the next 2 years,
yeah,
I'd say.
Bandwidth is the bigger problem.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, I don't see it. Maybe it will. You know, maybe Fios will be rolled out further and we'll have some new DOCSIS standards for cable to get us up over like, you know, 50 to 100 megabits or something.
Yeah,
but
maybe,
you know,
some more WiMAX deployments will happen.
Yeah, but 3 meg DSL and even 5 meg cable, it ain't going to cut it for like, you know, storing all your photos online or something.
I don't think any United States bandwidth would cut it.
Yeah.
Maybe if we were in Japan.
Yeah, well, Fios is getting there. I mean, you can get, you know, 45 megabit Fios for like $79 a month or
something. Okay, yeah, I'll give you that.
Or $149.
I keep forgetting that, you know, 0.001% of the population has Fios because Verizon said, hey, we'll give it to these 10 people and then we'll stop.
Hey, they have it in Harrisburg.
That's the thing. Like, Verizon gave it to a couple big cities and then they're like, okay, phase one's over. We're done. We're not giving it to anybody else. Yeah. That made me so mad. But last thing to talk about Apple and Microsoft is an article about Microsoft. And it leads to what I think is a big problem, or what will be a big problem in the future. Before I get into the article, have you seen any of the ads on television for Windows Phone 7?
Yes, I did. I haven't seen them on TV. I saw two of the official ads that came out during the launch.
Did you see the one of everybody using their phone and walking into things? Okay, so obviously they don't have a good marketing department, because their entire ad was, hey, look at everybody using not our products. You know, so they don't have anybody in charge that is good with advertising. Well, now they don't have anybody in charge of software. Because their chief software architect, Ray Ozzie, the guy that took over after Gates left, is stepping down. We don't know whether he's being fired from the position and being put into another position, or stepping down, because they're not replacing him. Microsoft will no longer have a chief software architect. I think this is a huge problem, because now they have nobody to set the direction to say, this is where we should go, this is quality software, this isn't. There needs to be, you know, they're going to have too many disparate departments. They're going to have the Windows department. They're going to have the Office department. That chief software architect could have been that position to look over all of their software that they do for everything and say, this fits with our mission. This is good.
Well, on the other hand, they talk about in this article, you know, somebody asked Ballmer about, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, he tried not to dismiss Ray Ozzie, in that he was sort of the driving force between their move towards the cloud. So I really think that this might be part of their strategy, in that they've told all of their software departments, deploy to the cloud. And then the OS part of their division is just saying, let's hook into the cloud. So if they deploy these like service oriented type applications that are in the cloud, then all of their OSs, which really comes down now to basically server OS, a desktop OS, and a handheld OS.
Right.
And I guess maybe like Xbox 360, like the appliance OSs.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're kind of a special case. But even still, if they can attach into this like, you know, DLNA stuff and UPnP and all these like, you know, technologies of like discovering services and just, who knows, maybe there'll be some new standard with Microsoft Azure. Or is that how you say it? Azure?
I don't know. I don't know.
Anyways, I think that this might be their way forward, and they don't really need a chief software architect at this point. It's sort of like a distributed software environment.
See, I hope you're wrong, or that they implement it in a way that you don't rely on the cloud, because I want to be able to use Microsoft Office when I'm not on the internet.
But you might be able to with like some of these technologies, like the one-click deployment stuff. You initially set up over the cloud, well, over the internet or whatever it is, and then once it's sort of cached, it's there.
And that's what I hope they do.
Right.
I hope it happens that way. That, because what I don't want to happen is, you know, like I just said, I want to use something, but oh, I don't have internet connection, because that's the way it works now with Steam. I downloaded Portal onto my Mac via Steam because I love playing Portal. I cannot play Portal anymore unless I am on the internet, because every time I open it up, it says, oh, it's, you know, a couple weeks old. We think we have to update now. We're not going to let you play until you update. What the hell? You know, I want to play my game. I have it. Why can't I play it? I hope that isn't what happens with Microsoft's cloud services.
Yeah, there's definitely some, you know, logistics to work out, but...
And I think that was the job of the chief software architect. Make sure things like that don't slip through.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, I guess we have to wait 2 years.
Maybe Ballmer has it in hand.
Doesn't do jack.
I don't know.
He's a figurehead now.
The thing is, though, I don't know how big a deal. I think there's been a lot of turnover at Microsoft. But it might be a good thing. It might be them finally ridding themselves of some of the old...
That could also be.
Now, Ray Ozzie was part of that Grooveware... or Groove software that they had took over a few years ago.
That nobody used, and I can't even tell you what it does.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it came with Microsoft Office, but I never opened it up.
I think that might be where those new Impression Suite tools come from. That's their like answer to Adobe stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I
never heard of it.
Expression, Microsoft Expressions or something like that.
Yeah, I got nothing.
I think you can do like Illustrator type things, and it does like... Well, it's one of their. I think one of them is their Silverlight tool. It's like their Flash designer tool.
Right, right.
So
yeah, so moving on, getting away from Microsoft and Apple, we have one story here that is very, I don't want to say important to us, but it's something that we have talked about offline many, many times. And that is that Dig version 4 sucks. And this article from VentureBeat talks about the new Dig CEO apologizing to the Dig community for Dig version 4 sucking. And one thing that was pretty cool that was pointed out is that Kevin Rose, who founded Dig and was at one time the CEO, tweeted out a little survey just to ask all of his followers on Twitter whether or not they wanted the bury button back, because that was taken away in version 4. It was kind of like a little, catchy thing. You could dig a story or you could bury it. And they took that away. So now it's back because they figured out that everybody loved that feature.
Yeah.
Once they listen to their people, who knows? They have good ideas. So, we both hate Dig version 4, what they've done with it. And
yeah, it's awful. I mean, I think it's a travesty. They're going to study what happened to Dig. Well,
in economics classes,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, it's like that. I mean, seriously, because we're talking, like, I mean, if you're not into, like, the internet news cycle, and, like, the whole memes and everything else, you may not really know much about Dig or Reddit, but, or what's, like, some of the other ones that are out there?
Slashdot.
Yeah, Slashdot, sort of. Slashdot's a little more, like, scientific.
Yeah, there are other user community news sites that are smaller that I'm not aware of.
But anyway, this whole thing with Dig is just, it's a travesty, because it was definitely the biggest news site. I don't know how many page views a week,
day,
but it was big site, and it's just, I mean, no one's, somebody had a statistics on the traffic, and it was just like abysmal, like a 90% decline in traffic or something.
Yeah. Before we go on any further, just because, I realized whenever you said that a lot of people listening might not know what Dig is. So, before we go on, Dig is basically just a news site. It's a site where you can go and find all of the things that are happening now. But unlike MSN or the Washington Post, where they're submitted by editors, they're submitted by you and me. And then you and me also get to go through and vote on stories. The stories with the most votes appear on the front page because they're the most interesting. So it's really user news.
Yeah. So, and it tries to sort out, like, if two people submit the same link and it's like, hey, did you really mean this link? Or,
right.
It kind of does that, like, contention resolution. So,
yeah. So it started out awesome.
Yeah.
But now, if you haven't seen this before, this might not make sense to you. But if you have, you know how Dig used to be. Now, Dig is basically a Twitter clone. Whenever you go to the Dig front page, you get to see, quote unquote, my news. And my news means you have to follow Dig users, and you get to see the news that they like instead of just the news that the entire world likes. And that's what I liked about Dig. I subscribed to their main RSS feed, and I could see all of the top-rated news.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to see your news or another friend's news. I just saw all of the most important news.
Right.
And now it's like, what?
And you could filter. You could say top news in 24 hours, top news in 7 days, top news in 30
days. Top news in technology only.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. You could filter down. It has some of those features, but the top news page, you just, like, the stuff's so old. Like, you're like, oh man, this story was like big, like, 2 hours ago.
Right, that is so old.
Well, but it's usually more now. No, but yeah.
I know what you mean. It's something that if there was breaking news, you saw it before it happened.
Yeah.
Like, you knew about a hurricane before it hit land. Now it's like, oh, that happened? Okay, I guess I missed the boat.
But I wanted to add one other thing related to this whole Dig adventure that they've had. And it was sort of late breaking. It came out yesterday, so it didn't make the cut for the show today. But on TechCrunch, They have an article that Dig is facing accusations of gaming itself.
Gaming itself?
Yeah, gaming itself to fail. Now, I don't know why, but there's a user, a former digger, that...
Is it Mr. Baby Man?
No, I don't think so. It has done some data mining, according to TechCrunch, and turned up evidence that there are dummy accounts under Dig's control that have been promoting certain sources, and there's really no activity from these users. So they're like, they get promoted to the front page for some reason, but there's like not a lot of activity.
So are they kind of like super accounts that they can immediately promote stuff?
I guess.
That's weird.
The article, you have to check TechCrunch for the article. It goes in a little more detail, and they have a table listed there with like the number of digs and that the person's done, and it just doesn't seem to line up right. So I don't know. They're kind of insinuating that Dig is running the table on itself for whatever reason. Like,
I don't understand that. Like,
me either. I don't get it either. But I mean, TechCrunch makes some pretty crazy assertions once in a while.
They do, yeah. So I think this is one of them.
Take it with a grain of salt. But that said, it's kind of hard to believe how bad they've fallen on their face.
That's true.
You know, it's like, you almost have to wonder if they like tied their shoelaces together before they started walking.
And here's the thing, you know, companies have been offering to buy Dig for a long time. Kevin Rose has had to turn down offers. Jay Adelson has turned down offers before he stepped down was fired as CEO. So a lot of people have wanted to buy Dig. They could have made millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah. Now, Google offered Rose $200 million like 5 years ago.
Right.
Or whatever.
Now, who's going to buy them?
Yeah.
That's why I don't believe that failing, you know, purposely failing story, because if they were going to try to fail, I think they would have taken some money first. They don't have any money now.
I don't know.
You know,
man.
So why would they fail?
I don't know.
It would be something like have somebody give you money for your site, fail, and then quit and take the money with you. You know, but they didn't do that. They don't have any money from any companies. So this is weird. I think TechCrunch is wrong, and I think they have literally just screwed up big time.
Yeah.
Let's hope that they can turn it around, though, because I still like Dig. I still use it a lot.
Well, I have to tell you, I switched to Reddit, and I only found Reddit because I was still using Dig, and I happened to find a link that was linked to Reddit. And, you know, I find the Reddit, it's slicker, it's slimmer, and it there's more churn and turnover in the articles, and it's less, you get less of like the Michael Jackson effect, like with that,
right.
You know how Michael Jackson, that when he died, that story just kind of like has the all time number of hits.
Right.
You don't have that sort of like super, super stories, but you do get like really popular stories with like a couple thousand votes.
Right. And on the other hand though, you don't get as many or maybe as good of ones just because the population isn't there yet.
On Reddit?
Yeah. You know, because
True.
They don't have as many users as Dig.
I think
Dig.
You find smaller, funnier, weirder stuff there than you would. Less mainstream.
I did try Reddit for a while, and it was the weird stuff that made me not want to go back. Like, I'm there looking for interesting technology stories, and all I saw at least 20 times a day promoted to the front page was, it's cool to be an atheist.
Or, well, yeah, there is a lot of that. It's a very anti-theist...
Yeah, I mean, and I don't care. You know, people have their own opinions, whatever, but I'm looking for technology news, and I can't get that going to Reddit because there are all these other crap stories submitted.
Well, you just pick the channel you want. There's a technology channel.
Oh, it was horrible. I went away. Maybe they didn't have channels when I first started using it because I couldn't find a way to filter. But
they're right across the top there.
Maybe I'm just an idiot. It's always possible.
Let's see here. Well, I take that back. They're not across the top. Yeah, they are. Well, there's a science one. Maybe there isn't. Oh, yeah, technology. Here we go. Technology.
Is there an RSS feed for technology?
I don't know, because I don't have an RSS. Because I don't think...
Well, do you have the icon in the... Like, all browsers should have an RSS icon somewhere.
I don't think Chrome has one.
That is why Chrome sucks.
If you can do that, I don't know how.
Yeah, that might have been the reason why I stopped using it for real then. Is because I don't actually go to websites to get news. I have an RSS reader that reads stuff. So if it didn't have a good RSS link, that might have been why I stopped using it. But either way, let's move on a little bit. One cool thing now that Amazon is doing, which is awesome, is if you have a Kindle, you can now allow people to borrow your electronic Kindle books. This has been the biggest complaint about electronic books since day one. Anytime you have an electronic product, people compare it to the real thing. And that was the biggest complaint, is that if I have a real book, I can lend it to you and you can read it. Mm-hmm. But if you bought a book on a Kindle, can't do it. You have to give them your $400 Kindle in order to lend somebody a book.
Right.
But now Amazon's like, okay, you know, we'll relax a little bit. Now if you buy an electronic book, you can quote unquote, lend it to somebody. Mm-hmm. You can beam it to them or whatever they call it.
Beam it.
Yeah, there's some restrictions, but...
Well, yeah, it says it's enabled by the publisher or author.
Per publisher. Yeah, yeah,
they can choose to enable or disable it on each different book.
14 days only, maximum. Yeah. What was the other thing? Oh, kind of like a real book, when you lend it out, you can't read it anymore. It's disabled on your device.
Yeah, I don't understand if they disable it, why they put the time limit. It's like...
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, you should just be able to like recall the book whenever you want.
That's true. There should be a recall feature.
You know, it's like, oh, I'm you're not lending that book. I'm like, I want my damn book back right, so I can read it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go track you down. I'm just going to push one button and get it back.
Exactly.
That's what we need for everything. One button to get it back.
Yeah.
But do you think this is a cool thing for
Kindle? I do. I think it's a good idea. I wish the movie and music model would have followed this to begin with. I think this would probably cut down on piracy a lot. I think you'd get a lot of people that buy content, and maybe a few that would just borrow it. You know, they probably wouldn't have bought it anyways, but you know, you get more people to see your product and raise a little more awareness about your product.
And that's what I was just going to say. You know, I don't think they're worried about privacy. I don't think they're worried about piracy so much as they're worried about, will more people buy our stuff?
Yeah.
You know, so do you think this is going to get more people to buy books? If you can lend it to somebody, they can read it for 2 weeks and then it gets automatically taken away. Do you think people are now going to go buy the book so that they can have it?
Maybe. That might be one reason for recalling it. I think that I think it's a good thing no matter how you look at it. I mean, even if the restriction was 5 days, it's good that they're letting people do this. It's good for the users, and it may be good for them in the long run if it encourages more purchasing.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have done it if they weren't going to make some money somehow.
Yeah. Well, and libraries have been worried about this. Lending libraries,
right,
have been worried about a switch to an all electronic book world.
You don't need a librarian anymore. Fire the librarians.
Well, not so much that, but more just like, how do you lend out books if they're only digital? Like,
that is true.
You know, you can't, if you don't have a way to lend them out. So this opens the door for that possibility.
That is a good point. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. Well, I think they actually mentioned that in the article. So.
Oh, you can tell how well I read the articles.
Yeah.
So let's move on now. We have a couple stories about privacy and security. And I'm actually going to interject one story in at the end of this segment because I just saw it today and it's freaking awesome / awful depending on who you are. So I have to get it in there. But the first one I think is really cool. And maybe everybody doesn't know, so I shouldn't start by saying everybody knows. But if you've been to some websites, we've talked about this before, sometimes you might get a little bar at the top, a Facebook bar, you know, that shows you might be on the Wall Street Journal's website, but at the top of that website, there's a little blue bar that shows you're logged into Facebook. Share this with your friends. Like it. You know, comment on it. So sites are using your Facebook login to track you and, you know, make sites more social, whatever. We all know, if you listen to this show, that's a horrible thing. But a Google engineer has taken it upon himself to make an extension for Chrome so that you can just completely block that from ever happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the service that Facebook gives to third parties is called Facebook Connect. This Google engineer developed an extension called Facebook Disconnect. And it's really cool the way it works. I mean, I shouldn't say it's really cool. It's really easy.
Elegant.
Yeah, it's elegant. He didn't do anything like hacking the API or blocking API calls. He just said, if you have this extension, we will not allow TCP connections to the Facebook API. Like, done. Just cut them off.
Hmm.
So it's. I think that's cool that there's no programming necessary. He's just blocking the connection.
Right. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, if you want that I have a little, like, what do I call it? They're called bookmarklets.
So the little JavaScript things.
Yeah, and I have a little Facebook share bookmarklet that I just use when I want to share an article. I don't typically use the website's sharing
right.
utility.
And that's okay because that's when you want to do it and only right. when you want to do it.
But I wonder if that disconnect would then disable that JavaScript bookmarklet as well.
Well, it depends. It depends how that bookmark or what URL that bookmarklet accesses. Because the extension, the Facebook Disconnect extension, only blocks access to whatever the URL is that the Facebook Connect API comes from. So as long as your bookmarklet isn't using Facebook Connect, which I doubt it is.
No, it's. I think it's actually using. Well, it's a you know it's using a little JavaScript command, but in the in there the site is facebook.com/share.
Yeah, so I don't think that's Facebook Connect.
Right.
Yeah, so you should be good. And that's honestly, people, if you want to share
I don't even know that the share. I'm not even sure that the share function on most websites is even using Facebook Connect. I think it's
you have to have that bar at the top. If you just have like the button, the share button, or the like button, that's not it.
Yeah, because the scary thing with Facebook Connect is that it can actually like it'll like bring up things on your page like, oh, your other friends liked this link.
Right. We saw you were browsing this. We noticed that two of your other friends were also browsing this.
Right. Like, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's creepy stuff.
Yeah.
So unfortunately for now the extension is only for Google Chrome, the browser Google Chrome. So if you use that, great. If you don't like Facebook Connect, which you shouldn't, you know, go download it. But Brian Kenish, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, says that he's going to make the extension for the other browsers as well. So look for that soon, everybody, you know, who doesn't want Facebook Connect, which should be everybody. So make sure you start looking for Facebook Disconnect in a couple weeks and see if you can get that for your own browser. But keeping up with Google, we talked a while ago about Google collecting private data via the Wi-Fi cars, the Street View cars, whatever. You know, we didn't think it was that big of a deal, but apparently Google thought that all of these privacy concerns being brought to them were a big deal because they're making some changes. And I just wanted to mention these changes and say I think they're cool. First one being, they're appointing somebody as a director of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like I said before about, you know, the chief software architect, they need that one person in charge. Google's doing that for privacy. They're training their people in addition to just making them sign a paper that says, yeah, we'll abide by privacy guidelines. They're actually training them and showing them what they should do and what they shouldn't do with user data. And in addition to training them, they will be auditing every piece of code that they write that handles user data in any way, shape, or form.
Hmm.
They have to keep a record of how they gather data, how they store it, how they use it, where it goes. Like, they're cracking down on privacy.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes Google's almost operated like a little government. Like, they're like, you know, so they have a privacy czar.
Right.
And, you know, they have a policy.
Well, really, would you be against Google running the United States? I wouldn't.
It depends, I think. Well, here's my only problem with this is a lot of times when you do this sort of thing, when you put somebody in charge of some arbitrary concept, and I'm not saying that privacy isn't important, but I think it, I don't know, you get these policies that are just handed down that make life harder for everyone else.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
I've had that happen to me. I'm sure you have.
I think it's something that, you know, a lot of parts of, you know, different institutions that this sort of happens. And that'd be my only worry. You know, I think it's good that they're doing this. I think they could stick to training, you know, and just auditing the code.
Well, I think that might, you know, maybe that is the only thing that this director does is they're in charge of the audits. You know, maybe they're not going to be making stupid policies.
Yeah.
That would be cool if that was the case.
Yeah. But, see, I guess.
So I guess you do agree, though, that it's good that they're actually caring.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than not caring, I guess.
I guess if you put it that way, that's true.
Yeah, you know, but I still don't think they did all that much wrong. Like,
Oh, I don't think they did either.
Like, if you're broadcasting Wi-Fi data,
you're an idiot.
I mean, yeah, it's your, you have at least in the United States, you have a right to receive any wireless transmission with the agreement that you will not divulge the contents of that. It's a law, you know. So,
and think of it this way. If you're standing outside and somebody is standing 5 feet from you talking to their friend, there's no law that says you can't listen to them.
Right.
You know, that's the equivalent of Wi-Fi, open Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's in the air. It's being given to you.
Right.
You can listen.
And, you know, people, you could draw some, like, you know, like, oh, well, what if they took the data and they analyzed the data and found out that a lot of people spent their time this way on the internet, just for instance. It's like, well, it's a public thing, first of all, the internet. You're broadcasting it on a public airwaves. How is this different from them just staking people out in front of every Starbucks and
shoulder surfing?
Yeah, just checking out like what you buy. And I mean, people were allowed to do that.
Right.
There's nothing against,
there's no law against
it. Yeah, there's no law against that. About just, you know, just saying, oh, you know, we find that men tend to buy
porn.
No, I say men, you know, men tend to buy, they at Starbucks, they might tend to buy, you know, coffee, and women tend to buy a latte or something like that,
right,
or vice versa. Or, you know, men tend to buy Rice Krispie treats and women tend to buy the oatmeal or something. I don't know.
I buy the oatmeal cookies.
Yeah. I do like the oatmeal cookies.
They're good.
They actually have good oatmeal too, like actual oatmeal. They used to.
They have actual oatmeal at Starbucks?
Yeah, they did. They used to put the oatmeal in a cup, like it was a small, like, bowl-shaped cup. And then they just took the hot water from the spigot, and they put it in there, and they'd stir it up, and they put the cap on and let it sit for 3 minutes in this, like, super hot water. And then they gave you a topping, like nuts, brown sugar, berries, whatever you wanted.
How did I not know about this?
They might not have it anymore, though, because I don't, you know, oatmeal's not a real popular item these days.
I would get it.
Yeah, you know, I love oatmeal.
I'm going to have to ask for it, because I stop at Starbucks every Monday before I teach. You know, that's my breakfast.
Yeah.
I get an oatmeal cookie and a caramel macchiato.
Yeah.
So I would get oatmeal if they had it.
I did for a while. It was good oatmeal.
Man, I'm going to have to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, we always say that Facebook sucks. We were just talking about Facebook Connect and how bad it is. But here is one thing that Facebook is doing good. And I think this is amazingly awesome. Like, I want to hug the person who thought about this and implemented it. So Facebook understands that people log into their Facebook profiles from not their computers, from a, you know, somebody else's computer in Starbucks or from some random terminal in a store that nobody owns, that the store owns, you know, that anybody can walk in and use. And they realize that because of this, passwords get stolen a lot. So what they have implemented is a one-time password system. As long as you have registered your cell phone with Facebook, you can text OTP for one-time password to Facebook's short code 32665, and they will send you back a one-time password that is only good for 20 minutes. So even if somebody is monitoring your session and stealing your stuff, you log in, that password's done. Can't use it again. Even if you don't log in, you have 20 minutes to log in. But how awesome is this?
It's pretty cool. I have to say, it's I'm gonna, you know, clap my hands, we'll slow clap. The, you know, Facebook security guys. I think it's a good idea. That's not saying that there might not be some, like, holes in this. Like, I don't know how secure SMS is. I mean,
right. Maybe somebody can monitor your cell phone and get that.
One thing they might want to do is, like, maybe prevent changing your password while using the temporary password.
That could be.
You know, sort of to, like, help thwart anyone stealing that temporary password.
And here's another thing that the article didn't say, but I hope that they do, is that as soon as you log in with that one-time password, it's done.
Yeah, immediately.
It's disabled. You can't re-log in with it.
I guess that's why it's a one-time password.
Well, yeah, that's true. You know, the thing that got me is that they mentioned the good for 20 minutes thing.
Well, that's probably how long that password's good until you log in.
Right. I hope that's what it is.
Yeah, me too.
I hope you can't re-log in within a 20-minute period.
Yeah, hopefully that would be the case.
Yeah, but this is awesome.
Yeah.
But
you know, there's a lot of information out there. I recently had to log into a system at work that required a 14-character password.
Can you say without giving anything out what system that was? Like, what ran it or what OS made you?
It was just a web page.
Oh, so somebody just made a web page that.
Yeah, it was a site like that had training on it and stuff like that. So yeah, 14 characters, and it enforced the uppercase, lowercase, you know, one special character, numbers,
the
and letters.
The three-thing rule.
Yeah. Oh, like four things, like upper and lower, special character, and a number. So
wow.
Yeah, it was really, really stringent password, right? And I started thinking about it. I'm like, there's got to be a better way to do this. Like, there has to be a better way, because it's getting to the point. I keep a file, and I'm not going to say where.
On your desktop, a text file, unencrypted.
No, it is encrypted. It is encrypted. But, that keeps a lot of my accounts, because I'm getting to the point where, like, you know, some of these accounts, you have to cycle passwords. And
there's no way to remember.
Yeah, there needs to be a better method, like a... I don't know. I've actually thought that maybe they just need to make passwords such that, like, make them really easy to remember, like real simple words, but you get one shot. If you mess it up once, it's locked out and you have to call or go through some third party, or not third party, but like
I know what you mean. Some way of resetting it to prove that you're you.
Right.
That process is going to suck, but at least you can remember your password and get in the first time.
Right, because if you make your password real simple and make all your accounts have that, then it doesn't matter that your password's the same for every account. As soon as somebody logs in, tries an account, and in one shot, they mess up the password, because they can't figure out your password unless they try several times.
Unless they have multiple tries, right.
Right. So if you just lock it on the first invalid try, now maybe that would be a pain in the butt for people.
Well, it would force people to learn how to type.
Yeah, you know, that's true. Yeah. I don't know. There's got to be some way to I don't know.
No, I agree. Password requirements suck.
Yeah, it is.
Like, my passwords are... My passwords to the normal person look like random junk.
Yeah.
And to me, they are random junk, but they're pronounceable random junk.
Yeah.
Like, I look at it and I can make a word out of it and say something.
I usually make mine math problems. Like conversions between units.
Okay.
And stuff like that with like special characters in there.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of what I do.
Yeah. I think they're pretty much unguessable.
I would hope that mine's unguessable.
Yeah.
But still, it sucks. But, move on one more story before I... No, you know what? I'm going to put in the story that I wanted to throw in that didn't make the cut yet because I just saw it today, because we just started talking about, you know, Facebook and their one-time passwords and how it's cool that they're being so secure, and that's the way to go. But there is a new extension, a new Firefox extension that has been released that basically makes anybody able to hack into anybody's anything. Ever. I know it sounds stupid the way I said it, but it's true. It's called FireSheep, and it is an extension for Firefox, Windows and Mac, not quite ready for Linux yet. But it puts up a nice little sidebar on the left-hand side of your screen, and it has a single button that says Start Capturing. And when you are on a Wi-Fi network, you press that Start Capturing button, and it starts listening for traffic going over your Wi-Fi. And what it does, it doesn't listen for usernames, it doesn't listen for passwords, it listens for cookies. Because here's the thing. Everybody thinks that their site is secure because the login page is done with SSL. And that is kind of true. That's a good thing. You want that to happen. But if after you log in through an SSL login page, the page stores your cookie and then reverts to not SSL, your cookie is broadcast every request in plain text. So this extension captures those cookies, stores them for you, and all you have to do is click on it once, and it takes you to that site and logs you in as that person.
Huh.
So if you were browsing Facebook right now, because we're on the same wireless, you would show up in my little FireSheep sidebar. I would click on it once, Facebook will open, I would be you instantly, because I now have your cookie. This is
what if the I mean there's probably like ways to prevent this though, like if
there isn't. The only way to prevent this is end-to-end encryption from login until logout using SSL, and most sites don't do that.
Yeah, what about like what if I spread it across several cookies, so you needed like 4 cookies in your cache for it to work correctly?
Oh, if you were the web designer and you did something like that, maybe that would work.
Yeah,
I don't know, but for most sites, there are multiple cookies for most sites, but most sites only use one cookie to store your I'm logged in information.
Huh.
So if you want it, you know, and you use Firefox, go search for FireSheep and download it. He gives screenshots. He shows you how to use it.
And, but these other people would have to be on your Wi-Fi network as well.
Yes. It either has to be used on open Wi-Fi that anybody can get on, or you would be trying to steal people's stuff from your secured Wi-Fi network that you're both on. So it's really only useful for open Wi-Fi networks.
So really, well, yeah, that's true, but even still, like, you right now you could steal my stuff.
Yes.
If I were like in the process of logging in though.
No, if you are using Facebook, because every request you send your cookie so Facebook can verify that you are still logged in. With every request, every click you make, your cookie gets transmitted again. Every site does this.
Well, why wouldn't they just download JavaScript into the browser and the JavaScript would look for the cookie?
Because that still has to be sent back to the server to be verified.
Yeah, but then it could just send a yes or some programmatic like response.
But the JavaScript wouldn't know that you're still supposed to be logged in. Only the database on the server side knows that. You know, if you transfer that information to the client, then it never expires.
Well, no, it would expire when you close the browser, when you terminate the JVM session.
So you're saying just have JavaScript that always answers yes on the client side.
Not always.
Until you click the logout button.
Right. Well, no. Basically, every page request, the JavaScript on the page would get re-downloaded on that new page and check your thing for cookies.
I don't know. I don't know how that would work.
Yeah.
But I do know that every site, the way they do it now, is the cookie gets retransmitted. That's this might be a problem with the HTTP protocol in itself, because this isn't something you program. This is just something that happens when you use cookies on a web page.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, we've talked about the extension HTTPS anywhere or everywhere a couple weeks ago. You need something like this because Facebook is the biggest problem site. You can log in. Facebook will not send you to an SSL site. It's all unencrypted. If you go to https://facebook.com, you can log in securely. But as soon as you log in, it flips back to unencrypted.
Right. Well, that's like Google used to do, and now you can say always do HTTPS.
Right. Yeah, Google was the first site ever, you know, or the first major site that people use to go completely SSL.
Yeah.
So, so be careful. You know, go get HTTPS everywhere and use that extension to force Facebook to always be secure, because, you know, we've said before that it's only a matter of time until it's one-click hack. Now it's one-click hack.
Yeah.
You know, the matter of time is now. Somebody did it.
At least on a shared system.
Right.
The other thing is they could change the protocol so that this actually might be a problem with Wi-Fi. That the connections point to point should be encrypted rather than encrypted across the whole.
Well, it is specifically a problem with Wi-Fi because a Wi-Fi router is a hub, not a switch.
Yeah.
So all traffic is spat out to everybody.
Yeah.
So if you're on a physical hardwire connection, this isn't going to be useful to you. It's only over Wi-Fi.
If you're on a hub.
Well, yeah, if you're on a hub, then it's useful. But on a normal network.
Who uses a hub nowadays?
Seriously. Yeah, so it's only useful over Wi-Fi. And, I mean, it's scary.
Yeah.
It's scary now that this has been released to the public and anybody can use this. You don't have to know anything. You can literally be an idiot. Because I don't know, you probably can't see because I can't turn my laptop around, but the screenshots, like, it shows you your Facebook icon, it shows you the name you're logged in as, it says Facebook with the Facebook logo. All you do is click on it and bam, you're in. Like, you don't have to know anything.
Wow.
It's scary. So Fire Sheep, I had to say it again. You know, just so Fire. I'm saying all this scary stuff and now I'm telling you to go get it, but go try it out. You know, it should scare you. If you get this and you see it work, you're going to be scared to death, and you're going to do something to make sure that you use SSL all the time.
Yeah.
So last topic on privacy is, do you remember a couple months ago, the school that gave out MacBooks to all of their students, and then they decided to spy on them with a camera?
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, so that lawsuit has been settled, and the students won. And I just want to, the whole thing of me putting this in here was just to say, you know, the school got, you know, hammered for this.
Yeah.
You know, they finally lost. But another reason that I wanted to put this in here is just because I think it's ridiculous how they lost. So this, in the settlement, $175,000 gets put in a trust for the student that filed suit, $10,000 for a second student who also filed suit for the same thing. The lawyer who made the settlement gets $425,000.
Yeah.
What?
Well, all I can say is how long did the lawyer spend on it?
I don't care. Not $425,000 worth. Not if the student gets less than a third of that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's frequent to sue for court fees, you know. So.
But further down, the district's insurer has agreed to pay $1.2 million toward the legal fees and settlement costs.
Right. So, well, that's probably if there's anybody else that comes into it or they
right.
start a class.
But either way, like, the district gets that.
Yeah.
So this is the $425,000 is free and clear money to that lawyer.
Yeah.
This is just a problem with our legal system. That's,
well,
that's
there, on the other hand, you might not be able to find somebody to be able to prosecute the case if there wasn't a big payoff in it. It's a risky thing, you know, because you're at the mercy of a judge and the facts of the case. So.
Yeah, there might not be anybody good enough who could have gotten this settlement.
Right.
So you're paying for...
And not only would you have lost, you wouldn't have ever been able to set the precedent.
That's true. Now there is a precedent.
Yeah, so.
Which is another thing that I hate about our court system.
Oh, I love precedent. Precedent's great.
Precedents are horrible.
No.
Court cases are decided on precedent instead of the actual facts. Because they say, oh, well, we gave this guy this, so we can't not give this guy this. We have to do it the same way, well, or that guy's going to sue
it's
again.
It's not so much that.
But that's what happens.
Well,
I mean, that's the way our court system works now, is that if there is a precedent, no matter what the facts show now, they have to do the same thing they did on the precedent.
The dangerous thing is they're starting to use precedent from foreign courts.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah, which is bullshit, but anyway.
Okay, so enough. This isn't a law show. Maybe we should do a law show.
Yeah.
So we have a couple stories about television and movies, and I finally got a chance to see The Social Network. I know you have also, Ryan.
Yes. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, everybody should have seen it by now. It's been out for 2 or 3 weeks. But one thing that was cool is that everybody was wondering how Mark Zuckerberg would react to a movie about him that portrayed him in such a bad light. Well, somebody actually asked the question. He spoke at Yahoo's Y Combinator event over the weekend, and the whoever the lady was who was interviewing him asked the question. So why don't we just take a listen now real quick and see what Mark has to say about this movie.
What is the biggest difference about what actually happened?
I mean, where do you want to start?
One of the biggest ones.
I don't know. It's interesting what stuff they focused on getting right. Like, every single shirt and fleece that I had in that movie is actually a shirt or fleece that I own. So there's all this stuff that they got wrong and a bunch of random details that they got right. The thing that I think is actually most thematically interesting that they got wrong is the whole framing of the movie, kind of the way that it starts, is I'm with this girl who doesn't exist in real life, who dumps me, which has happened in real life a lot, and basically the frame it as if the whole reason for making Facebook and building something was because I wanted to get girls or wanted to get into some kind of social institution. And I mean, the reality for people who know me is I've actually been dating the same girl since before I started Facebook, so obviously that's not a part of it. But I think it's just, it's such a big disconnect from, I think, the way that people who make movies think about what we do in Silicon Valley, building stuff, right? Like, they just can't wrap their head around the idea that someone might build something because they like building things.
So what do you think about that? I actually think that was a very good explanation.
I do. You know, I kind of agree. I think people do like to build things just to build things, but they build things for a reason.
Ah, so you don't quite believe his just to build it story.
Right. Well, no, I mean, people build things for the purpose of building them, not to get back at somebody necessarily, but they do it for some inner desire for something there.
And for a lot of people, that could just be pride. Like, they want to build something and see a lot of people use and be like, hey, I built that.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, and I think there's a somewhat of a selfish drive there. You know, I don't think it's wrong to be selfish in that manner.
And everybody wants to do something good.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I still don't think that alleviates what I think it really was about. And it was, you know, sort of this like voyeuristic part of college law, you know, that everybody wants to know what everyone's doing,
right?
At least here's where, with his statement, he's put himself in a position, a precarious position, in my opinion. And I was thinking about on this on the way over. Either he's lying, or he didn't foresee the way that it would be used.
That could be true.
I don't. Either way, he's not really coming off as like all that, you know, or smart. If he's lying, then he's just fine. He's covering up the reason he really built it, because he was interested in what people were doing. He's a kind of a voyeuristic guy, or just like looking at pictures of girls. I don't know. You know,
who doesn't like that?
Well, right. But I'm just saying, like, it's definitely a voyeuristic thing. Like, it's one thing to look at people's information who put it out there on purpose it's another to sort of like subversively get that information.
Right. The way they showed that he started it.
Right. Now, I don't know if that's true. It is just a movie and it was written by writers that live in Hollywood and they could have embellished a lot of detail. But that said, either he's lying about that fact or he didn't foresee the way in which it was used, which I think is probably the worst of the two, meaning that he didn't have the insight. Like, he just built this like thing to like, why would you build it? Like, what are you looking to do? Because Facebook at first was not about sharing pictures and sharing videos and, well, sharing pictures maybe.
I think that was the only thing it was about.
Yeah, but it was not about creativity. Like, I think a lot of people use, like, I see a lot of artists and I see a lot of, like, creative people use it as an outlet for their ideas, for their art, photography, music, you know, interesting things, sharing, and that social... That like the good parts of it, like the social sharing aspects from people who are disconnected physically. But I still think that a large portion of people are into Facebook because it's voyeuristic.
I would agree with that.
So, and that's probably the big percentage. And to sort of like not foresee that,
I don't know how it started. Yeah, I don't know if he didn't foresee that though. Like that seemed.
But then that means he's lying.
Yeah. Well.
If he foresaw that, then that's the reason he did it, for the voyeuristic reasons. And that really just comes down to, like, he wanted to know. It really wasn't... I don't think it was really about impressing his girlfriend. Like, I think there are parts of that that they made it seem that way. Like, that's what people in the movie said about him.
Right.
But I didn't get that impression. I got the impression that, like, he was pissed at his girlfriend about what happened. He wrote that nasty blog. But when he created the whole...
But then none of that really happened.
Well, right.
Because that girl wasn't there, so the blog never happened.
Right, so the blog never happened. So he didn't do it for that reason. So that means he had to have some other drive. And I just don't understand why you would pull all that information together.
Well, I mean...
Like, why would you want all the people's pictures and information in one place? Why? Other than to look at it.
Well, let's look at it from the way that I would look at it if I were him. And I've done similar things like this before. I see other people or companies or whatever that do something and I think, wow, they did a horrible job. I can do better. I'm going to go do that right now. I think that's what he did. He saw all of those online directories of students in dorms and said, wow, this is horrible. I can do so much better.
Or
and
he
did
just
in
stole,
one night.
Or he just stole the idea from the...
Well, that was later on.
Or whatever their names were.
Yeah, that was later on. But the initial thing where he just grabbed everybody's picture and made an instant... you know, online directory, he did what I do on, you know, on occasion. I see something that somebody does that sucks, and I say, I can do better than that in 5 minutes, and then I go try to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason.
Well, the timeline, I'm trying to remember the timeline of the movie. Did he do that before he talked to those...
That was the first thing that he did.
Winklevosses?
Yeah. Yeah, the Winklevosses.
Winklevosses.
Yeah, that was the first thing that he hacked into every dorm server, downloaded pictures, and made a face mash.
Face mash.
Yeah. So that was the
face
first
mash,
thing.
But that's what I mean. But like the idea.
Well, that was the starter for Facebook.
Right. I know. But Facebook itself, I think either he did it. I think Facebook itself was either he did it for voyeuristic reasons or he did see the potential for it. And I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
He stole it from them. I don't see how he comes out of this looking good, though.
I don't think he does.
There's no way out of this. Like like I said, he's either lying about why he did it or. He did not have the insight into like why it would be so valuable, or he stole the idea. Did see that and stole the idea from the Winklevosses.
The Winklevosses.
Winklevosses.
I think that is a funny name.
It is hilarious.
Yeah. So obviously, we're just speculating. We have no clue what.
Yeah,
the real
this is. We're basing this on a movie, but I mean,
the only person who does know the real story is him, and he's obviously
and
not
maybe
telling
Eduardo.
Anybody. Definitely Eduardo.
Yeah, I would love to see an interview with that dude.
I want a movie.
They did interview him for that interview Eduardo for that movie. So
do they have it on tape?
No, but I think they talked to everybody in the movie except for Mark.
Really?
That's what I watched an interview on Charlie Rose with Aaron Sorkin and the director. I can't remember the director.
I don't remember.
So that's what they said.
I'm gonna have to go. Is that online somewhere?
Wherever Charlie Rose, and he's on PBS.
Okay, I'll have to go check that out.
Yeah.
So moving on, our first television story, and I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. This is a article on The Hill, thehill.com, And the FCC approves changes to the cable card rules. So for those of you who have no clue what that means just by the headline, if you own a TiVo, you know what this means, because your TiVo might be able to DVR stuff, but you don't have a TV guide on the TiVo. You're basically just setting up your machine to record from 8 to 9 p.m.
No, you can get the TV guide.
Can you?
Yeah.
Because you couldn't for a long time.
Well, maybe not for a long time. You can. Here's the problem, though. They have this cable. You can get the cable card, but it doesn't work. Like I have a friend with a TiVo, and he had the cable card. He has two TiVos, two cable cards. Every month, on the same day of the month, without fail, he has to call TiVo and get them to call the cable company to re-enable the cable card.
It disables itself?
Yeah, because there's like, it's something that like that the cable systems, they do it so that like people don't steal cable and like hack the boxes basically.
Right.
But they are failing to put like the ID number on the cable card into their like monthly updates in the database.
So when it runs again, it's gone.
Right.
Yeah, so that is a big problem. One of the problems that this article brings up is the TV guides on devices not from the cable company.
Right.
You know, so that was always a big problem, that you could record stuff, but you never knew what you were recording unless you had a physical TV guide in front of you. So basically, they came out with some new rules saying, you know, you need to make channel listings available to third-party devices that are, you know, running cable cards and doing these things, and hopefully they'll fix that disabling thing.
Yeah.
But, either way.
Oh, it's just a big runaround when you get the... They don't want you to have these cable cards. They want you renting their box.
That's exactly... Yeah.
Which I don't even understand, because it's like rent a $400 box for $5 or rent a $50 cable card for $2. Like, it seems to me like they'd be making out on the cable cards.
This is why nobody should have cable. Yeah. Do it some other way. Dish, DirecTV.
Well, Dish is even worse. I think they're even less open to third-party devices.
That is true.
Yeah,
that is true. I use the Dish DVR, and I, you know, it comes with the TV guide because it's part of it, and I have no problem. But yeah, if you want to have a third party with a bigger hard drive or whatever, you're probably running into trouble. But I do think this is a step in the right direction.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a good
step. They're not relaxing the rules. They're forcing cable card to do things that they never wanted to do before, which is good for consumers. So last thing about television, and this is, I want to say a horrible thing. We talked about Google TV a while ago, and now Google TV devices are coming out. There are set-top boxes. It's actually being built into a Sony TV that is coming out or is already out. But here's the problem. Google TV, one of the cool things is that you could use the power of Google search to find stuff you want to watch, whether it's on right now, like physically coming across the airwaves, whether it's on your DVR, whether it's on an on-demand system, or whether it's available via some streaming over the internet. This one Google search through Google TV was going to let you find content no matter where it was in the world, anywhere, doesn't matter. However, all the major networks except for Fox are now blocking this.
Yeah.
ABC, NBC, CBS say, Google TV, you are not allowed to access our streaming services on the internet. So good luck with that.
Well, yeah, they're basically saying, instead of accessing our content legally, you can go access it illegally.
Exactly. Did they think this through?
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand this at all. I've been saying this for a while. I think the network's got to realize they need to find a way to provide the advertising or strike a deal with the people providing the content to get the advertising dollars out of them or get the money out of them.
Right.
And then they do the advertising to make up the difference. However it works, they need to sort of like, in a way, like deregulate, like split their content from their distribution system. And I think that's part of the problem. They have a lot of money wrapped up in the distribution systems, i.e. paying FCC licenses.
Right.
And, you know, their whole network affiliates and all other crap that, you know, I think the network affiliates are worried probably because people are going to stop watching local content. And, you know, your local stations, they make money from the local advertising.
Right. All those ads you see from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Right. And there's increasingly more news online. But it's like, hello, local TV stations, wake up, put your content online.
Exactly.
And then Google TV will get to it, because I'm still going to want to see local news.
I think one of the cool things that our local news is doing now is they're putting clips of the news online.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
So WJAC, you know, if you miss something that came on at the 5:30 news, you can go online and it's probably there. So that's awesome. If all local news stations did that, especially if they did that with the entire broadcast, that would be amazing.
Yeah. I think I like, this is my advice to WJAC and TAJ, the local stations. Get hooked up with Google TV as soon as you can. I don't know how you do it. I have no idea. I haven't looked into it. But you should try to put your content on your website so that Google TV can see it.
Right. Figure out how they search for things and put it up there in that manner.
You know, like your nightly news show and your morning news and all the stuff that you put on, the sports games you cover, all that stuff.
Put the four main newses on there. Morning, noon, afternoon, night.
Yeah.
Put that up on online.
Just think, you don't even like, you know, you could, if you're a local news outfit, you could go videotape, and I don't know if you need the permission of the school or not, but you could go videotape local games, football games, put them on your website, you know, stream them
my
to your website.
My personal website. Yeah.
And then I'll just watch the games from the comfort of my own home on Google TV.
Right.
You don't need to stream them up to the network. Like, it's not, you don't need network time or to steal away from your network time. You know, these local stations could, and you can put, you know, TV spots in there.
Right. Yeah, I would, honestly, I would love to see football games from my high school that I went to, but I'm not driving long way to go to the actual field to watch the games. If it was streamed somewhere, I would watch every game.
Yeah, and like, would you put up with a couple ads?
Yeah, it's whatever.
Like, I mean, it's just like any other football game. There's timeouts and stuff. And
show me a commercial between the quarters and during timeouts. Yeah, whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
those people are silly.
The major networks, they are really losing it here. They need to step up and get back on. Yeah. Because
affiliates, just go around them. Just provide your local content. You don't need the networks.
And before we move on, I also want to bring up another point about Google TV. Do you think anybody's going to use it? And here's why I say that. Because as of right now, if you're not buying a new TV, it's another box that you need that hooks up to the box you already have that hooks up to your TV.
Yeah. Well, I think they'll probably start providing this in other boxes. Like, there, I think there's a DVD player that might have it, or a Blu-ray player that has it.
Not sure. That would be cool.
I think there's a Sony Blu-ray player that has it. That you're right. I'm tired of like more boxes, but yeah. I think this could be like the box to end all boxes. Like, you know, if they do it right,
I think you're right. If
it gets Netflix streaming, you don't need a Blu-ray player.
They still need to find some way to get major broadcast.
They do. Yeah. I mean, this is a huge roadblock here with them dropping out. But that's why I think it's so silly, because what do the major The networks must have some agreements with the affiliates. That's the only reason I could see this. And Fox might have more wiggle room because they weren't always a real big network like the other ones. So.
Yeah, just recently they became big.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do think if Google can work out some way to get regular broadcast TV, like from stations that you normally get on your cable or dish, into their box, and if that's all you need is a Google TV box, I'll buy one right now.
Yeah,
I would love that.
The only other thing I'd say about it that's maybe a slight roadblock is bandwidth again.
Everything depends on bandwidth.
Yeah, if you want to have three people watching different videos in your house,
which will be possible with a device like this,
right? And use the internet for like surfing,
right?
Or downloading, you know, torrents. Your whereas,
right? Your wares.
Yeah, I mean, you know, then you need you're gonna need more bandwidth than what we have now. So
moving on to a couple stories about mobile phones, getting away from the television and the movies. And this one is kind of a leak. You know, we see these every now and then whenever Best Buy, you know, gets a new shipment of something and somebody will snap a picture real quick and upload it. Well, this happened with the AT&T store. They got a little pamphlet in that tells them, hey, whenever you're giving out SIM cards for phones, you need to be careful now. Because now we are shipping out standard SIM cards and LTE SIM cards. So it is very clear by this little pamphlet that all AT&T stores got recently that they are pushing out LTE in the areas that have it. You know, they are now selling or going to be selling devices soon that are LTE devices because they are stocking SIM cards that are LTE. So I think this is cool.
It's cool. I don't know that it makes it simple. I don't know if you read the writing beside each one of the SIMs. It says, under the standard SIM, it says, use this SIM for all phones except the iPhone 4. And then under the new LTE standard SIM, it says, use this SIM for all phones except iPhone 4. So I'm not sure it's totally clear which SIM goes with which phones.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the SIM on the card, they look exactly the same size. So they're literally going to have to figure out, maybe it's printed on the SIM in some small writing somewhere. This is, you know, 3G. This is LTE.
Well, maybe, but it says use it for all phones. Both say...
That's what I mean. Like, the only way to determine is maybe to get out your magnifying glass and look at the SIM itself.
Yeah.
Because the paper doesn't say.
I don't understand what they're saying there exactly.
Yeah, I understand the reason for that message because the iPhone 4 uses a micro SIM, not a full-size SIM.
Right.
I don't understand why they duplicated that to make you think that they're both the same. So AT&T employees are probably going to be really confused.
Yeah.
But I do think...
It's cool, though. LTE on the way.
Yes, exactly. I think the underlying point of this article was cool that the people like West Virginia, where there are LTE towers, HSPA plus towers, that they can now buy phones that use them. So, big plus. I hope it comes around a lot. I hope it comes to Johnstown. I hope Johnstown's next.
Yeah.
How awesome would that be?
I'll tell you what, if there were like super duper fast LTE speeds from AT&T, I'd consider switching, you know, to get maybe like just to get a Wi-Fi device or something.
I've had no problem with AT&T around here.
Yeah.
And I travel to some places like Crescent where my college is, and service has always been 10 years behind up there. And I never have dropped calls. You know, I have 2G service. It's slow.
Yeah.
But I never have problems.
That's the thing. There's no 3G in Ebensburg in the Crescent area. That's awful.
Yeah, that sucks. But I don't have dropped calls. I don't lose stuff. You know, it's not bad.
Yeah.
So anyways, getting away from, or maybe not getting away from the iPhone, because this article from The Electronista compares the iPhone with Android in terms of ad sales and making money on the ad networks. So the Millennial Media reported that Android is now making more money than the iPhone on one of the ad networks. So they're not saying Android makes more total ad revenue than the iPhone. They're not saying they make more altogether revenue as in handset sales. They're just saying that Android is now catching up to the iPhone. On one of the ad networks, they are making more money than the iPhone. And I think they're pointing out that, you know, look in the future for them to overtake. It seems like Android is coming on pretty strong.
Yeah, the growth rates are kind of, you know, exponential with Android. I mean, they've been very good for iPhone as well. But,
right. But
iPhone's, you know, sort of like, I think it may be, tapering off because there's so much more option out there with, there's, you know, all four carriers now have Android phones.
That is true.
The major ones in the United States.
Well, I think you can say that all carriers, even the stupid ones like Boost Mobile.
Yeah, they may have them as well. So, I mean, pretty much everybody has them out there, and only one carrier has iPhone. And this is going to be a problem.
That is going to be a problem. However, you know, we've all been seeing the rumors, even more so now. People are starting to say that, oh, you know that white iPhone 4 you've been waiting for? Yeah, they're not doing that anymore because the iPhone 5 is going to come out like in a couple months.
Yeah.
So, if that happens, everybody's saying, you know, CDMA, which means Verizon, or LTE, which also means Verizon.
Yeah, I still think that releasing a phone on Verizon with just CDMA, I know they need to get it on Verizon.
I don't think they're going to do that.
But man, like they're like way behind the curve on Verizon. Like, I'll admit, you know, Verizon's 3G isn't the fastest thing out there anymore because of the upgrades to HSPDA and stuff. Right. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do a CDMA iPhone like everybody's saying, or a current generation Verizon iPhone. Yeah. I think whenever it does come to Verizon, it's going to be LTE or some newer version of EVDO,
yeah,
you know, something faster. But either way, Android is catching up. You know, Apple still has them on device sales, but they are definitely catching up. So it's going to be good competition. Apple's going to have their hands full when they start releasing new phones with all of the new Android phones that are coming out, because the feature sets are very similar now.
Yep.
So last story is about Apple again, and this one just kind of made me laugh. The link that is in the show notes actually died in between the time that I put it in the show notes and we're doing the show. So if you want to search for this, you know, just search for the title of the article, Apple Gets Anti-Sexting Patent. And you'll probably find the story from the Economic Times, which is where I'm at now. But basically, Apple got a patent that means they can have settings on their phone to determine what is allowable and what is not allowable in text messages and other things that you can communicate with on their phone. So they can have parents set up settings on their kid's iPhone to say that certain words are banned from text messages. And if they have any sort of face detection or genital detection algorithms, they can block sending pictures. So
I think this is, I don't know. What do you think?
I honestly think this is stupid.
I do too.
Because, and here's the reason why. If Apple does this, then kids who want to sext are going to buy different phones.
They are, or they're just going to find ways around it. Like, right. This is classic, like, nanny state crap with, like, yes. Doing parents' jobs for them. If you're worried about your kids, like, you know, sending illicit text messages and pictures, then, A, don't give them a phone, and B, if you do give them a phone, you know, watch what they're doing on it.
Right. Like, monitor it. Check it every week.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Apple would be better to, like, make unerasable logs.
There,
like,
you go.
That would be the best way to do it.
And every text message gets logged.
Force parents to get involved in the equation rather than doing their jobs for them. I just think that's...
Well, here's the cool thing. Maybe it's not cool, but anything that you delete from an iPhone is pretty much still there. Like, it doesn't actually delete it. They don't give you a good way to get it. If you're a hacker, you can get it. But if you like delete text messages, they're not deleted. They're still there.
But eventually it deletes them, right? I mean, after, like, for space or something.
Yeah, after some amount of time, but not within a couple days.
Yeah.
So it would be cool if Apple made some sort of tool that parents could load up on their computer, open up a program, and say, pull me all text messages. And it even gets the deleted ones to see what's been going on.
Right.
But they don't have that yet. So, yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, I just think this is silly. Like,
oh, yeah, it's completely stupid. I don't know what they were thinking. Or maybe they weren't thinking. Maybe this is a patent, because you know patents take forever. Maybe this is something they thought about 6 years ago when they first decided to make a phone, and it just finally got approved.
Could be.
Try to find this patent. They don't give the patent number. I should try to figure out the patent number and see when the submittal, the date of submission was.
Yeah.
That would be interesting to see. But anything else you saw?
No, that's about it.
Since we had a slight delay between making the show notes and recording the show, so some new stuff might have happened. But if it has, we'll catch it next week. And if you want to submit a story for next week, go to Delicious and bookmark it using the tag Slongcast018. Next week will be the 18th episode of the Slongcast. It's actually the 19th because we count from zero, like real programmers do. But Slongcast018, as usual, you can find me on Twitter. And on Facebook, my username is Slonkak. You can find Ryan on the same place as Twitter and Facebook, username Ryan Lancey. And I hope everybody here has a wonderful, wonderful rest of the week.